Thank you. We go on to case number 2, 092805, Claret versus Roberts.
May it please the Court, G.G. Gilbert on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Patricia Claret. Judge, it's undisputed that Patricia Claret, a 53-year-old mother, was tased 3 times for 5-second durations inside her home by Lansing police officer Stephen Roberts, while 6 other officers were present. Judge, even under the defendant's version of the case, this is excessive force. So you have to ask what went wrong, why the jury found against the plaintiff and in favor of all defendants. And Judge, I submit to you it was the convoluted jury instruction given by the district court regarding excessive force, the crux of the case.
Well, now, you just tell me, how could the harm component of the excessive force instruction have had any impact in this case where the evidence of harm was essentially undisputed?
Well, Judge, implicitly throughout the case, the defense attorneys attempted to imply that plaintiff wasn't injured, even though the evidence of her injuries was overwhelming. For example, they said, well, we used a taser rather than a baton because the plaintiff could have been injured if we used a baton. And we didn't want to go hands-on with the plaintiff because of the possibility that she might be injured in the small confines of the bedroom. So although it wasn't explicit throughout the case, implicitly they argued that she wasn't injured because they were nice enough to only tase her 3 times. If they had gone hands-on with her or hit her with a baton or used mace, then somebody might have gotten injured. It wasn't only the harm element that was improper in the court's excessive force instruction. What the court did was adopt and align itself with Greg Matthews' direct examination of Stephen Roberts. In other words, Greg Matthews very cleverly crafted a direct examination of Stephen Roberts that asked him to explain, well, why did you use the taser? Why didn't you use a baton? Why didn't you use OC or mace spray? Why didn't you go hands-on with this 53-year-old mother inside her own house? And basically, Stephen Roberts then explained to the jury, well, I didn't do this because she could have gotten injured. Well, then the court basically takes that language and crafts its own instruction completely off of the pattern instructions that has 4 paragraphs that basically make her alleged interference with the arrest of her sons and resisting her own arrest contingent on the excessive force. So the 4 paragraphs in the instruction make the excessive force contingent on you finding that she didn't resist arrest or interfere with the arrest of her sons, and that's just not the state of the law. And then the last portion of the court's instruction, the court states, there's no special rule in regard to the use of a taser. Whether the use of force takes the form of physical contact by the officer or the use of some other kind of weapon, such as a baton or a taser, and then it goes, the question in every case is whether the kind and degree of force used by the officer was reasonable viewed from the standpoint of a reasonable officer confronted with the circumstances shown by the evidence. Judge, by using this language, they lifted Greg Matthews' direct examination of Stephen Roberts. And the problem with this instruction is that it sides with the defendants and it adopts their theory of the case, aligning the court with their theory of the case. It's undisputed that the second tase, even the defendants admit this, was when plaintiff was down on the ground on her back. She was laying down, and this instruction doesn't account for that second tase when she was down on the ground on her back and tased for 5 seconds.
I'm going to ask you to please go on to the limiting instruction argument. Given that Ms. Claret testified that she had no prior convictions, wasn't it proper for the government to impeach that testimony with the prior convictions? And isn't the real issue here whether the court erred in refusing the limiting instruction?
Yes, Judge, that is an additional real issue of why the instructions in their entirety were misstating the law and misleading. I proposed a limited instruction. The defense introduced her conviction for retail theft and her conviction for obstruction of justice, indicating that these were impeaching convictions because she had been tricked in her deposition, and she stated in her deposition that she had never been convicted. She was not confronted with these convictions during the deposition. She was asked a general question whether she had ever been convicted of any crimes other than traffic offenses.
Why do you say tricked?
Well, because the defendants knew, we had fronted, that she had suffered a severe automobile accident prior to this incident, that as a result of an accident she was in a coma for 31 days, and that as a result of that she was slow. She subsequently went on to get Social Security disability after this case, but she wasn't as quick as the average person. That was very evident at the trial. So during her deposition, they just ask her a general question, oh, have you ever been convicted besides a traffic offense? And she says, no, I haven't. And then it comes out, without even being tendered, the certified copies of the retail theft. And I tried to clear that up and say, well, this should just be used for impeachment purposes.
Where's the trickery?
Well, Judge, the trickery is if they would have asked her, well, on this date and time, were you convicted of retail theft? Did you plead guilty to retail theft? Did you plead guilty to obstruction?
There's no requirement that they lead her in a deposition.
Well,
and it's
Judge,
not trickery to ask a generalized question. That's a very common question and should have been anticipated, and she should have been prepped for it.
She should have been prepped for it and lived and learned. But the problem was I did try to cure the error. It wasn't like I didn't try. I asked and proposed a limiting instruction that this, especially given that the issues in this case were so similar to these convictions. In other words, you had an obstruction and a resisting charge in this case, and you had a theft possession of stolen goods in our case. And then
what reasoning did the district court provide in refusing to provide the limiting instruction regarding the prior convictions?
Well, in refusing to provide the limiting instruction, the district court said, give me 1 second.
I don't want you to take up any more of your time.
Judge, basically, I had said, I was the one who had in my instruction set a limited instruction that it shouldn't be considered his substantive evidence because the issues were so close in this case. And the judge said, basically, I'm not going to give your proposed instruction. He didn't elaborate on exactly why he refused to give that limiting instruction. And, Judge, that's why I think even more reason the instructions as a whole misled the jury and misstated the law. Additionally, you have the issue of the expert testimony given by Stephen Roberts. And this is ironic. The defense moves in limine to exclude any interpretation of the taser download, stating that you need expert testimony to do that, and no expert's been tendered by the plaintiffs. The judge denies that motion and says it's just like a speedometer, that the taser download says what it says, and the person arguing that it somehow malfunctioned is the person who needs the expert. Well, then, sure enough, we called Stephen Roberts on direct as an adverse witness in our case in chief, and he claims no knowledge whatsoever of how the taser download operates. The jury asked several questions because the six entries of the download is inconsistent with Stephen Roberts' testimony that the taser was only fired three times for five-second durations, and sure enough, when the defense calls Stephen Roberts in their case in chief, he becomes an expert on the interpretation of the taser download and not only the six entries that were relevant for October 11th, 2005, but the entire year of the 585 activations of the taser download. And Stephen Roberts gives opinion testimony that based on an extrapolation theory, well, during the year, this couldn't have been possible, and this couldn't have been possible, and this couldn't have been possible for whatever reasons. Based on 585 and my extrapolating those malfunctions, I believe there was a malfunction in the taser download October 11th, 2005. And it's exactly that that even Judge Grady said, if you want to say that taser download malfunctioned, you need to get an expert, disclose that expert, and that didn't happen here.
I thought everybody agreed that she was tased three times.
Judge, her theory was that she was tased continuously from the moment that Stephen Roberts entered her house without a warrant and she protested to all the officers coming in. And the overriding, in other words, continuous tasing would have caused the six registrations as opposed to three.
I don't understand continuous tasing. From the moment they walked in the door until she was subdued, she claimed she was continuously being hit.
She claimed that he had the taser gun on her the whole time. What had happened was the probes never disconnected. In other words, when the two probes discharge from the gun and make contact with her, the probes never lose that contact till they're removed after the third tase. So her version of what happened was, I turned, I said, you can't all come in. Stephen Roberts activated the gun without warning. I was tased in the living room by the door, not by the bedroom door. And I was tased the entire time, meaning that the probes never disconnected from her body.
Well, that's not the same as an electrical current flowing for that entire time period. Was that her contention? That's just implausible.
Well, her contention was that she was repeatedly tased.
I thought everybody agreed that there were three deployments of the taser and that that wasn't really an issue in this whole business about whether there was a malfunction in the taser because the digital readout showed six trigger pulls. It was sort of a sideshow because everybody agreed that it was deployed three times.
Both versions, the plaintiffs and the defendants, Judge, it looks like I'm going beyond my time.
But you have to answer the question.
Okay. Both versions, under both versions, each side said they were tased three times. Where exactly was the difference?
Mr. Matthews? Only you will be arguing, or will Mr. Slick be arguing?
Both will argue. We had agreed on a split of time. If it meets the court's approval, I'll address whatever questions the court would have for me, whatever you prefer.
What was your split? Because we don't have it written down.
I'm sorry. It was going to be 8 minutes for myself and 7.
Okay, that's fine. You have both of you. Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is Greg Matthews, and I represent defendants in this case, Steve Roberts, Timothy Byron, Dan Powers, and Dana Tatchenhorst. There's actually two of those. And I want to apologize right off the bat because on page 13 of my brief, in the second subheading on the page, I stated that Steve Roberts was a member of the Lansing Police Department. That is a typo. He is, or of the Linwood Police Department. That is a typo. He is a member of the Lansing Police Department. I really think in this case that the result of this trial can be summed up by a point that's mentioned in the appellant's brief at page 23. I think we have to take into account that this is a trial that lasted close to a week and a half. It had over a dozen witnesses testify. And during the course of the trial, Judge Grady adopted the practice to permit jurors to ask questions of witnesses as they gave testimony during the case. And the question that's mentioned in appellant's brief, one of the jurors, listening to all of the evidence in this case, asked the question, why, when Officer Roberts tasered her the first time, did he not handcuff her then instead of continuously keep tasing her? That was one of the questions submitted while Defendant Roberts was testifying. Defendant Roberts answered that question, and he answered it to the satisfaction, obviously, of that juror as well as all of the other jurors in this case.
What did he say?
I can give you the lengthy description. What he said was, at the time he entered the became engaged with the plaintiff in this case, she had just invited two Linwood officers into the home to talk to her sons. They had gone back to her bedroom to talk to them. They were investigating a burglary that had occurred the night before. They went into the bedroom. They observed that there were items that had been reported stolen in the bedroom of the plaintiff's sons, and there started to be some commotion and talking and so forth, back and forth, and defendants Roberts and Byron were asked for help, and they went to try to help, but the plaintiff pushed Roberts, went by him to attempt to impede the arrest or what she thought to be the arrest of her sons. Defendant Roberts and Byron then were behind her as she's going towards the door. Sergeant Roberts testified that he told her several times to back away from the door, stop attempting to interfere with the arrest of your sons. She refused to do that. She even went so far as attempting to push her way into the room past one of the Linwood officers who was standing in the threshold of the doorway. So she has now pushed Defendant Roberts. She has now pushed one of the Linwood officers. Sergeant Roberts warned her three times or more, as did Byron, that if she didn't stop this and back away, he was going to deploy the taser. Everyone agrees on this, except for the plaintiff herself during the course of her testimony. Her son agrees that his mother was being told to stay back, and that she wouldn't do it. She kept trying to go forward. Eventually, Sergeant Roberts deployed the taser. In fact, the probes made contact with the plaintiff in her arm and abdomen. This caused her to lose function of her muscle, and she fell to the floor into the bedroom. Now, in the bedroom, we have the plaintiff. We've got two Linwood police officers. We've got the two sons of the plaintiff, all in a tiny confined area. Sergeant Roberts followed the plaintiff into the bedroom. He leaned down to try to give her a hand to help her to her feet. And she wasn't just laying on her back. She was kicking him and kicking at him. And he told her again to stop. She wouldn't stop. He told her more than one time to stop. She wouldn't stop. So he discharged the taser again. And this immobilized her. His intent at that point was to get her out and away from what was happening at the point in time was the arrest of her sons, and to prevent some sort of a melee from taking place. He described during the course of his testimony he did not want to use a baton. He did not want to go hands-on on the plaintiff because if he jumped on her, tackled her, did something, this might incite her sons.
How old were her sons?
One was an adult, and I want to say 18, and one was 17 at the time.
Mr. Matthews, why did the court refuse the limiting instruction in this case? Did you oppose the giving of such an instruction?
Your Honor, I believe that was the co-defendant's objection and argument that the counsel...
Mr. Sink.
Thank you. There's more to the answer to that question, but Sergeant Roberts went on at length about the...
So the second use of the taser was because she's kicking him?
Yes.
And the third use of the taser is because...
Because once she then is helped to her feet by Sergeant Roberts and brought out to the hall, her sons and the Lewin officers are still in the bedroom, and they're being handcuffed. And she turns, he tells her to put her hands behind her back. She refuses to do it, and then she starts going towards him with her arms flailing in a threatening manner. He discharges the taser a third time. There's no question about that.
Okay.
And this, then she submitted to the arrest.
Well, there was a dispute. She had a different story, but the jury obviously accepted your client's story.
Yes.
Is this taser continually attached? I don't really know. I've never seen one.
What happens, the taser will have two probes connected thin wires that will actually shoot out and spread out as they get farther and farther away from the taser gun. I believe in this case the length of the wires is 20 feet, but since the plaintiff was 6 feet or so away at the time, it obviously, you aim center mass and hope to hit in a place that will immobilize the person.
But they were continually stuck to her. It just you can only
yes.
one target.
The probe itself, I mean, it actually has what is like a tiny tip of a fishing
barb.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to penetrate skin. It can penetrate skin, but if it stays just connected to clothing or loose clothing, that allows the circuit to connect and immobilize the muscles.
But it delivers a shock for only 5 seconds, as I
yes.
understand it, right? And then it stops.
And then it stops. And the testimony in this case was, once it stops, you're back to normal. And that's what allowed the plaintiff to start kicking at Sergeant Roberts when he went in to help her up between the first and the second discharge. The other point that I would make in terms of the instruction on excessive force and the court's discretionary decision to include the bracketed material from the pattern instruction on excessive force, I just briefly mentioned that in this case there was never any evidence or any argument that the plaintiff was not in some way harmed, and I would submit to the court that this is not the case for the court to reverse what was such a just result at the time of trial on the basis of that discretionary decision to include harm. Harm was never contested, and harm in the instruction or out of the instruction would have made no difference to the outcome of this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Christopher Slick. I represent the Linwood defendants, appellees, who are Alberto Castillo, Dexter Bartlett, and Dennis Tatkenhorst. As an initial matter, I want to point out that in my brief and also in my argument, I'm not arguing regarding instruction number 7 excessive force, or because those are both directed only at co-defendants, and also the taser incident only involves Officer Roberts, who is also a co-defendant's client. What I would like to point out is...
I really would like to start you out, if you don't mind, because you don't have a lot of time. Again, why did Judge Grady refuse to give the instruction, and did you oppose the giving of such an instruction, a limiting instruction?
We actually did not oppose the giving of that instruction. In fact, I can read from the transcript exactly when this occurred. It's record document 143, page 22, and Ms. Gilbert states, Judge, we do have one stipulation to read. The court, okay. Ms. Gilbert, and Judge, just for the record, so the instruction I was going to propose was the pattern instruction of 1.15, where the last sentence says, you may not consider this evidence for any other purpose. It was plaintiff's proposed jury instruction number 39. The court, that's refused. So Mr. Oberts, who is our trial counsel, never actually objected to the giving of that limiting instruction. It was done by the court itself.
Given that one of the prior convictions was for obstructing a peace officer, the same charge as was present in this case, wasn't there a very real danger that the jury would use the prior conviction as propensity evidence? In other words, you know, to determine that she must have done that here as well?
Your Honor, I think in cases like this where a prior conviction is brought out as impeachment of regarding truthfulness, that there's always that danger. In this case, there are certainly some mitigating circumstances, first of all, that Ms. Gilbert brought out the fact of her client's convictions initially. It was not us who brought it out first. We followed up on cross-examination. And also the fact that this was brought up specifically, I mean, the motion to eliminate hearing, at all points this was brought up specifically for the purpose of impeaching her credibility because she lied in her deposition about having...
Not give the jury instruction.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Why not give the limiting instruction? I'm sorry.
Your Honor, there is no case or any authority that I'm aware of that would require such a limiting instruction. I think it was made quite clear to the jury that this was the purpose for which this evidence was being brought forth. It was never...
By whom was it made very clear?
Well, all throughout the transcript, whenever this was discussed in front of the jury, it was never brought out in terms of showing her propensity for committing crime. In fact, the judge refused to send back the certified convictions to the jury when he sent back...
Yeah, well, you can't unring that bell, and by failing to limit the use of the obstructing an officer conviction, wasn't the jury likely to use it to determine that she wasn't credible in testifying, that she didn't resist arrest, and therefore she's not credible on any of her other testimony as well?
That's a danger, Your Honor, but regarding the context in which this was brought out, it was clearly brought up for showing that she had lied in her depositions. In fact, Mr. Oberts, when he cross-examined her, and I can actually quote from that, he stated, Mr. Oberts stated, I know your counsel brought this out at the end, but ma'am, we talked about your convictions, and your counsel talked to you about convictions, yes. And you stated on the stand, you testified that you understood what the word conviction meant. Is that correct when being asked by your counsel? Answer, I've never been convicted. Question, that doesn't answer the question. Did you understand? This is all record document 147 at page 59. The entire questioning by Mr. Oberts on cross-examination was simply about, did you understand that you had convictions when you testified in your deposition that you did not? That was the sole purpose for which this was brought out on cross-examination.
The jury doesn't know that. The jury was never given a limiting instruction. The jury does not know that.
Well, the instruct...
That's an error that's central to the case, and it directly impacted on her credibility. I mean, what basically I'm afraid you're arguing is that a limiting instruction is meaningless and has no impact on the jury. That's why we have limiting instructions.
Well, Your Honor, I believe in the context, first of all, counsel for plaintiff appellant did not bring out any authority for the proposition that such a limiting instruction is needed in this context. And as I said, the context in which these convictions were brought out was very limited in its scope itself. To reiterate that to the jury once again in a jury instruction, I think, would be just cumulative. And
okay.
I believe I just have a few minutes left.
Sure.
Regarding the bringing out the convictions in terms of their admission initially, while it is true the judge did admit the conviction for retail theft explicitly under Rule 609A2, first of all, plaintiff appellant did not object to that at the time. In fact, never objected in the trial court whatsoever to this being not a crime involving dishonesty, not even in her motion for a new trial. She raised it for the first time in appeal. But even if that were an error, still that would have been appropriate, an appropriate admission under Rule 608B, because this was brought out for the purpose of challenging her credibility for truthfulness regarding the deposition that she had previously given. So whether or not the judge stated the appropriate rule or not is really irrelevant, because the evidence was admissible in and of itself, whether it was under 609 or 608. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Any rebuttal? How much time? You've got a minute. We gave...
Judge, on the trial...
Just let me finish what I was going to say, please. We gave the appellants an extra minute, so we're going to give you 2 minutes.
On page 873 of the trial transcript, I do state this part about witnesses and parties having convictions. What I'm afraid of, because of Patricia's misdemeanor retail theft and resisting conviction, that would be used as propensity evidence as opposed to just impeach her credibility. And then the court says, no, the defendants will not argue that. They are entitled to argue based on the reason I omitted it, namely, it goes to her credibility.
Give me the cite again.
It's trial transcript, page 873. And, Judge, this part about that I didn't argue in the trial court that her retail theft conviction shouldn't be admitted, Judge, in the hearing on the motion in limines, they brought in for the first time the certified transcript, and they even admitted counsel may not know that she's been convicted. We just got these yesterday, and I objected to and argued vehemently that this would be propensity evidence, exactly in confusion to the jury, and propensity evidence given the charges in this case.
One of the larger problems, though, with this whole evidentiary argument is that you put the evidence in prospectively or preemptively, I should say, but the Supreme Court held in the Aller case that means you waived any appellate challenge to it.
Judge, that was a criminal case where the defendant has...
If that's the rule in a criminal case, why shouldn't it apply in a civil case?
Because in a civil case, the plaintiff doesn't have the option of not testifying. So if you get an adverse ruling in a motion in limine, I don't want her to look like a bigger liar by not fronting the fact that she's been convicted of these convictions. And the dissent in Owner makes a great point that the treaties actually encourage the fronting. In other words, the dissent in the 5-4 decision of Owner says, it quotes several treaties, Wigmore on evidence. A party who has made an unsuccessful motion in limine to exclude evidence that he expects a proponent to offer may be able to first offer that same evidence without waiving his claim of error. Graham, Handbook of Federal Evidence.
Except we usually don't follow dissents.
I know you don't follow dissents, but I think this is distinguishable because in a civil rights case where there's such an uphill battle and the plaintiff's credibility is at issue against seven police officers, the fact that I fronted the information after a very clear adverse ruling in a motion in limine that was hotly contested and I certainly objected to, the fact that I didn't want to make my plaintiff look even less credible that she was going to look with these convictions.
That's the same sort of tactical decision that the defendant has to make in a criminal case when the motion in limine goes against him on prior convictions, even if it's wrong.
Well, sure, Judge, and there has been like...
If you make that decision to put it in preemptively, you waive it as an appellate issue.
Judge, there has been... Oler has been distinguished by, for example, the Iowa State of Iowa Supreme Court in State of Iowa versus Daly, 623 Northwest 2nd, 799, where the Iowa Supreme Court declined to follow Olner and concluded that the defendant did not waive his right to object to the court's admission of evidence by fronting the conviction.
Except the 6th, 3rd, 8th, and 10th circuits have applied Olner in the civil context.
Judge, but the Seventh Circuit has it, and I would...
Right, but you're asking for us to create a circuit split based on an Iowa case?
Judge, I'm asking you to create a circuit split based on the fact that this is a civil rights case in the Seventh Circuit where this issue has not been addressed, and to distinguish a civil rights case from a defendant's case where the defendant doesn't have to testify and the plaintiff does. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. All parties, and the case will be taken under advisement.